Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. My guest today is R.J. Stewart. He's author of Crazy Hawk, a dystopian post-apocalyptic, say that three times, thriller about a fierce woman on a rescue and revenge mission. And it's available on Amazon, Barnes Noble, and all the usual places. For everything about R.J. Stewart in the book, you can go to havartis.com. And R.J., welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ira. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about your background before we delve into the book. I'm more of a nonfiction person, but I always am fascinated with the lives of people who write fiction, because it's a lot of times it's based on their own experiences and they exaggerate a little bit here or add a little color there. But you are, your background is that you've been a Hollywood writer and for around 22 years, correct?
Oh, yeah. That's, if you count the years before I started working regularly, I was doing that for about three decades, 30 years.
So how did you get started in that field? What were you doing before? What led you to Hollywood?
I came to Hollywood as an actor originally. It wasn't long before I switched to writing. Enjoyed more, it used more of myself in writing. And I worked as a Teamster for 9 years. Now, when I say Teamster, this isn't cross-country hauling or something.
Right.
I was a delivery guy. I worked for a printing company. We had a bobtail truck and a step van and a Honda. And I would deliver. I frequently delivered to studios. And so I was very aware of Hollywood. One time Clint Eastwood sat in my car. I took an elevator ride once with Robert Blake. You know, so I was having a feel of being in Hollywood. And that sort of inspired me to start writing screenplays. And I wrote short stories at the time too, and I even started a novel or two, but I started committing full time to screenplays, and I wrote a screenplay called Good Company that was about a driver who drives around LA and delivers, also that he aspires to be a writer. So of course it was about me, and it got a lot of good reception, and Glenn Caron, who was at that time supervising producer of a show called Remington Steel, read it, and they hired me right out of the truck, so to speak.
Pretty impressive, and I remember Remington Steel. It was an enjoyable show. When you first,
I was the cubby writer on there.
Were there any challenges in writing that show? It was a light, in a way, a light show, but it was enjoyable. It was entertaining.
Well, it's interesting. They showed me the pilot when I came in for meetings, and they asked me, Michael Gleason was the executive producer and the creator, and he created it with Bob Butler. He asked me, be honest, what do you think? And we want honesty. Now, of course, many years later, I realized they don't really want honesty.
Nope.
But at that point, I totally bought it. And I said, well, you know, everybody's wonderful. It's a wonderfully done show, and I love the script. But the star of the show is this guy who's playing Remington, this Pierce Brosnan guy. That's the star of the show. And they kind of nodded because the studio had thought of it as Stephanie Zimbalist's show. And of course, Stephanie thought that way too. Stephanie, wonderful actress and a very, very, very kind, loving person. But, you know, it was clear to me, being an outsider, not knowing what the expectations was, that it was Pierce's show. And, I've been fortunate to work with a lot of those leading man types. I've worked with Kevin Costner and James Garner and Charlie Sheen. And when you go into the room with these people, you know they're a star. It's just some indefinable thing that of course carries into the screen, because that doesn't always happen. Working on a show was very valuable to me. I learned so much, got some excellent experience. And then when Glenn Caron went off to do other things, he took me with him as his junior writer, and I learned so much from him, and that began my career.
When you first were delivering to the studios, did you get a sense, because you appear to be a fairly practical person to me, I don't know you, but you come across as a very practical person, even though you're in a creative community, when you were driving into the studios and delivering, did the magic of the studios appeal to you, or did you just see them as just buildings you're delivering to?
I think at first I was just buildings and delivery. I wasn't starstruck at first. You might think it would be the opposite. I'd be right. starstruck, then become jaded. But no, it was starting to see celebrities and stuff. I realized, you know, this is a really cool world I'm in here. And I don't know. I think when you're outside of it and have no participation in Hollywood, which, well, I shouldn't say no. I actually had a good friend who worked, was a writer for Mannix and other shows like that at the time. Mm-hmm. So I had some little contact with it, but very little. And from that experience of going out of the sets and seeing people filming and seeing some stars, as I told you, Clint Eastwood one time, and I ran into Catherine Ross a weird amount of times. I don't know why that happened, but the result is I started to get sort of enchanted by the world, and so it's kind of the opposite of what you'd expect.
When you are in that world, it strikes some people as organized chaos. There's clearly organization to it. You can't be pumping out movies and television series without some sort of industrial size organization in the studios, but it does look to the outsider as somewhat confused or chaotic.
Oh, I think there's some truth to that, because, you know, I think William Goldman started his famous book on on his life in Hollywood saying, nobody knows anything. That is true. The, you know, it's movies and television are different, because in movies, you can always say no to a movie. You can always say no. In television, there's a limit of how much you can say no to, because you got this hole that's going to appear on the screen, you know, in a certain amount of time. And so you got to fill it. So I think that's why writers gravitate towards television, and now more and more, because there is more of a need for a product on TV. But yeah, you know, you never know what you're going in. You're developing a script. There used to be an expression called feature development hell. I don't know if they still do it, because I don't think it's used anymore, because they don't spend as much money developing scripts anymore as they used to. But I was in that hell for a while, where I would write a script, people would love it, I would pass it around, it'd be good for me, get interviews and stuff, but they weren't getting made, you know? So, like I said, you can always say no to a feature film. And, you know, getting the features made is kind of miraculous. I mean, if you got I worked on Waterworld with Kevin Costner, and I didn't mention him in the movie star list I was in. And, you know, when you're in something like that, you know it's going to get made, because this was Kevin Costner, who was at the absolute apex of his career. And so, you know that's going to get made. But so many of them do not get made. Like I said, television, you can. Well, that's changed too, because they don't make as many pilots as they used to. But, you know, the if you write a good script, the chances are it's going to at least get to pilot. You know, they'll actually see it filmed.
The economics of Hollywood changed so much over the last 10, 20 years.
Oh, my goodness. I have friends still working there, and I don't envy them. I mean, of course, if they're making great livings, because several of them are doing extremely well. So, I mean, good for them. But it's changed a lot, and I, you know, you've read about it. The strike had a lot to do with that.
Sure. Kind of stuff. And, in your book, Crazy Hawk, did you write it particularly, given your background, as you just talked about, did you write it with the idea of it becoming a motion picture or some sort of television?
Not really. I just love the idea of having total control of what I was doing. I mean, the ambition for a screenwriter is always to have a director come take the script away from them and make a movie, right? And then you have literally hundreds of people that are going to influence that script. And if good, they're going to make the script better. If they're bad, they're going to screw up the script. But I love the idea of, this is my work, you know, this is my book. And so I didn't think of it that way. Now, some show business people who really love the book, who've read it, you know, I encourage them, go make it into a miniseries or something. So I'm not resisting that at all, but right. I wasn't thinking that.
Of course, the terror of it all is that if it does become a movie or a television show or a series, even, that your control goes away as a writer.
Yeah, certainly in television, the writer, because they need you for the second episode, you have more control. You right. certainly have more control. That's why we become producers in television, not so often in features.
Well, tell us a little bit about Crazy Hawk. How did you come up with the idea? How long did it take you to write?
Let's talk about how I came up with the idea.
Sure.
When I was in college, I read a book called Canticle for Leibowitz. It's a classic sci-fi novel. It's post-apocalyptic. And my book is not much like it at all, except one thing. In the deep future, a group of monks discover an underground. This is the post-apocalypse. The apocalypse in that book, in Canticle for Leibowitz, is a nuclear war. And a group of monks discover a underground fallout shelter that's pretty much intact because the everything else had been ruined. And they start asking questions about what the world was like before the nuclear war. And there's a character, Leibowitz, who's a saint, and he was involved with the underground shelter and stuff. Okay, put that aside. So that put in my mind for decades, thinking about what if one of the themes of a book is the post-apocalyptic world, but the characters are trying to figure out what the world was like right before the apocalypse, and what the world they're trying to figure out is the world we live in, the world that Ira and RJ live in. And so that was the fun thing to start exploring. Then coming up with the characters, the key character is Deirdre. She's the center of the whole piece. She's Crazy Hawk too. I'll get to it in a minute why she's called Crazy Hawk, but when we meet her, she's on a mission of rescue and revenge. She's pursuing the men who kidnapped her sister, which is bad news for those men because if she has to, she will kill them, and she's very good at that. A lot of the story is about how she balances her penchant for violence with the way she treats the loved ones in her life. Her sister, of course, Mindy, her lover, Jube, who she meets on the trail, and her beloved soul horse, Danny. And in many ways, the story of her and Danny is the spiritual core of the story. And I had for years a wonderful horse, trail horse named Danny. And I dedicate the book to Danny. And it's a horse story in some ways, although it's the central character is Deirdre. There are many mm-hmm. long period parts of the story that Danny's not in, but certainly that is an underlying theme of it, her love for that horse. And then the development of the world and also her tribe. Her tribe is called the Hussars. And I go into a lot of cultural detail on what the Hussars are in contrast to other cultures.
Did you get any, of course, we're in the era of woke Hollywood. Did you get any pushback from people saying, how dare you, as a white man, write a female character?
Yeah, and her romantic lead is of African descent. Mm-hmm. At first, her antagonists are the Nations, which was a league of indigenous people, the Apache Nation, the Hopi Nation, the Navajo Nation, et cetera. So yeah, I was a little nervous about that, but so far, not at all. People have not gone there at all. I got real nice review from Kirkus that they didn't mention anything like that. So I was a little nervous about that, but I think maybe. Yeah, I know in Hollywood that is. I have white male writers who live in terror of that, but I don't think it was as applicable to a novel.
Good point. So Deirdre came to you full blown, or did you have to think about her for a while?
Oh, yeah, a lot of thought. So that gets to the other question of when did I conceive it. I started writing on it in 2014. Now, did it take 10 years? I said, not really, because unfortunately we had some family tragedies that distracted me from it. In 2014, our daughter was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and that she passed in 2018. So that was a major distraction.
Of course.
And I didn't work a lot there. I know there is a psychological truism, air quotes around truism, that if you're busy and stuff, those kind of tragedies are easier to cope with because you've got something to occupy your time. I did not find it that way. I was blessed that I was retired and I could concentrate on loving our daughter and eventually saying goodbye to our daughter and caring for grandchildren and stuff like that. So I didn't work much on the book in those 4 years. And then when I started working on it again after Lori passed, and then when COVID came, I said, you know what? The people ask, what did you do during COVID? And I want the answer to be is I finished that book. So the time frame is a little askew.
Mm-hmm. Did you incorporate any of the attributes of your daughter into the character?
Keep in mind, I conceived of the character in the book before she was diagnosed.
Right.
But certainly the emotion of there's death in the book. There's definitely talking about death. We see people die in the book. The death throes and the final breath. Do one scene, it put the point of view of someone who's dying. And I took that very seriously. There's no question that I was influenced by Laurie's.
You were writing that scene, was it tough to write because of the situation with your daughter?
I find using emotions, even extremely painful emotions like that, as writing them is a therapy. And I would say while I was writing it, I was inspired. I was driven, like, oh, I'm into something here. Now this is going to work because I understand what's going on. I'll tell you something. When my beloved horse, Danny, died in 2021, another reason I was doubled down to finish the book because now I didn't have her horseback riding to distract me from it. There's a point, I don't want to give too much away from the story, where Danny is in jeopardy. And I remember writing about Deirdre's reaction to that. And I really tapped into that. And that was, you use those things. But I think when you know you're using them and you know you're getting something out of them, the actual writing process, I don't think is sad. It's inspiring.
How is the writing process for you? Do you sit down at a certain time of day and for a certain amount of time, or you just catch moments and write?
Wouldn't life be simple if I did that? No, I go, 2 days where I'm just crazed writing like a lunatic, and then I'll say, I'll take a day off. And then a week later I said, God, I haven't written in a week. And then I'm back to lunatic time. So no, and I'm afraid I was that way. Even in Hollywood, where you have deadlines and people can't humor you that way, but it's just the way I am. The one thing about being a head writer on Xena, no buck passing,
you're
the one that delivers the script. Right. That scared the crap out of me, so I was more consistent there. But even there, I would bullshit all day long talking about sports, and then stay up all night finishing the script. So
how many writers were on?
I think I hear writers, including some of the interviews you've done, where they sound so disciplined. I just wonder if they might be less superior to me. But me and other writers I've known and procrastination. If you can't procrastinate as a writer, I question whether you're a writer.
That's a legitimate question. Yes. I procrastinate as a non-writer. that way I don't have to deal with that conundrum. But my approach is to write short stuff so I know I can get it done. If I have to write something long, whether it's a script or a book or whatever it happens to be, that would be more of the challenge.
Well, but one thing one of the things that I benefited from in the long period between when I started it and when I came back to it is perspective. So a lot of revisions and stuff. I revised the book over and over and over again, and I'm very pleased that the reaction people have, surprised how professional it looks, how much like a finished novel it looks. And I think that was because of all the revisions and the perspective I got from being away from it for so long.
How do you not get bored with revisions? I've always wondered about that of authors, particularly of fiction.
I revise my work both in Hollywood and the novel very effectively, very efficiently. So I actually feel like this is writing, you know. The blank page is a little more intimidating. That I wouldn't call that boredom. That's terrifying. looking at the black page, but I don't consider revising boredom. What is boredom is when you get to a kind of a copy editing stage or a proofreading stage, and you know you send it off to proofreader, and they come back with a lot of notes. And, oh my God, that's boring. But I think when I'm revising myself, I think I'm good at that, and. I thought as a head writer on Xena, I thought revising other people was very hard work for me because I wanted to throw it all out and start it all again. But, you know, I knew that was just I'm not David Kelly. David Kelly must work around the clock and never, you know, he must be so disciplined. If I throw a script out, that means I have to write a whole new script. So I have to learn, you know, this is what I was telling myself on Xena. I have to learn how to rewrite people without throwing their script out because I just won't have scripts. And that was hard for me, but I think I learned it. And
so in other words, you're saying perfection is the enemy of the good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, perfectionism might be a haughty term for television. Can we ever be perfect in television? Cause you got that hole to fill every week, but you know, my version of it seems perfect, you know, and I know that's delusional.
No, that's just ego.
Yeah, that's ego. Thank you.
Could be both, I guess.
But can you imagine, you know how much David Kelly works. I'm sure.
Oh yeah, how much he works. I admire productive people like that.
That is amazing. Yeah.
How did you end up with Xena? Was it based on a particular thing you did in the past? You just knew people, and they knew what your work was like.
Yeah. I had met with Rob Tappert several times, and they invited me in to take a shot at the pilot. And the understanding was that if they liked the pilot, then I had I was, you know, head writer, executive producer, and they'd run with it. If they didn't like a pilot, we'd go our own ways, which is a kind of somewhat unusual way to do it, but. I think we're all happy with that because I didn't want to be there. They didn't want me. Anyway, they loved the pilot, what I did for the pilot. And then I got 22 on the air and, you know what those magic words mean. And so we were off and running.
Excellent. There's a rumor I heard, and I know it's actually fact, that your family's roots go back to the 1830s in America.
Yeah. That's in New York. Yes. You know, the movie, Gangs of New York.
Yes.
Daniel Day-Lewis played Bill the Butcher.
Mm-hmm.
My great-grandfather in that time, no, great-great-grandfather, two greats, was Bob, the movie's Bill the Butcher. My great-grandfather was Robert Herring. He was Bob the Butcher. He was worked in a big butcher factory, you know, like what we would have today with a slaughterhouse, you know, right. Where they cut up the meat and stuff.
For want of a better term, yes.
Yeah. then, following the because how much can you get from the records you pick up on Ancestry.com is occupations is one of the things because he was a butcher for a while. Then his son became a conductor. And I don't know, I guess that was a conductor of streetcars, maybe. I'm not sure what a conductor would have been in the 1850s and 60s. There's a family tradition that this would have been my great grandfather, one great, was killed in an accident with a streetcar. So that's where I jumped to that he was a conductor of a streetcar. Making that stuff up, you know, and then my grandfather, Stephen Herring, this is all on my mother's side, was was, what was he? I can't remember what his profession was, but my, his son, my uncle Steve, was a telephone repairman, and we lived with him for many years.
Well, your next book
my mother explained that he was the only one that had a job. They needed telephone repairmen in the 30s. You see,
oh yeah,
30s, everybody was out of work.
Of course, the depression. I have a new title for your new book called "The Crazy Butcher." What would be the one thing you'd like people to take away from reading Crazy Hawk? And yeah, is there any hope
the thing
in Crazy
I
Hawk?
Touched on with the way. Well, actually reading it, I would like them to take away a lesson about the characters and how people can go from being ferocious enemies to friends if they have a common cause in which to unite. And because at the beginning it's tribal warfare, but they there's an enemy that is threatening them all, and so they unite, and that would be a wonderful message for people to get. But the thing I'd like them to experience, not necessarily take away from it, but is the reflection. What you can do in a book like this is you can create a whole new environment, this barren, chilling world where things have devolved and the technology we're so comfortable with has disappeared. But you can also reflect on the world we live in. And that's what a lot of the characters, particularly Deirdre, is fascinating, what the pre-breakdown world was. That's what they call the collapse of society and technology and the economy. It's called the breakdown. They call it the breakdown, the people in the future. And she's trying to figure out what was the pre-breakdown world. And so any little sample of that they get in her tribe, which are called the Hussars, they have a technician who's able to power through some solar panels that they found, relics of solar panels. I mean, because there's ruins everywhere,
Sure.
One of the problems I have with sci-fi, some of the sci-fi thing, is like the world we had just disappeared, and then sort of a new world came up. But there'd be remnants of our world there. And so you figured out how to use solar panels to power a DVD player. And it was sort of a glorious breakthrough. They got to watch DVDs of what life was like before the breakdown. And so the reflecting on our society through the eyes of the people of the future looking back on us is an important element of it.
And what's your future plans? Are you ready for another book?
Yeah, I'm actually the Hovartis, the book publisher that's my printing name. The Hovartis is spelled Hovartus, and that's Hovartis.com is my webpage. But the main character in a novel I'm working on is called Cicero Hovartis. And so it's deep future, deep, deep future. And in a way, I try to tie it into the novel I wrote. See, the novel I wrote takes place about 100 years after the breakdown. And the Crazy Hawk, and I'm imagining the breakdown's going to happen in about 50 years. Okay, so it's about 150 years ahead of where we are right now. And so, but the deep space sequel is suggesting that they are aware of Crazy Hawk as a famous revolutionary and not a revolutionary, a leader of the revival of society.
Well, we'll look forward to it, and that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been R.J. Stewart. He's author of Crazy Hawk, a dystopian post-apocalyptic thriller about a fierce woman on a rescue and revenge mission. And it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about R.J. Stewart, you could go to his website, Hovartis.com. And R.J., thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Ira. I enjoyed it very much.
Same here. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.